I jotted a few notes to remind.
And you saw this?
Are these the questions? Yeah, and I jotted down just a few things to trigger my memory, which is not always perfect.
Okay. Well, this is Bob Brown, and I'm interviewing Sidney Armstrong for the Mansfield Library Archives. And today's date, I believe, is May 21st, 2021.
Right.
Okay. Well, Sid, welcome here. We've had an opportunity to visit a few minutes before before we turned on the recorder, so I know we're going to have a very good interview. And I'll begin by asking what I ask many of the people that I interview to begin with. Where were you born and when were you born? And tell me a little bit about your family and your childhood.
I was born right here in Helena, and my family on each side, all Irish, all the time. The Cooney family, and that was my mother's maiden name in my mother's family. The Cooney family came to the United States as Irish immigrants. Two of them, who were young, met in Iowa, and Mariah Cooney and Thomas Cooney. They came in a covered wagon with a six-month-old baby and got here to Virginia City June 28, 1865.
Does that make you related in any way to Mike Cooney?
Not in the United States. We think our families may have been connected in the old country, and they've been friends, but not a direct connection, no.
Okay. For listeners for this interview, later on, I'll just mention that Frank Cooney was from Butte, and he was a Irish Montanan and became governor of Montana,
right.
And that's a good story in itself. And then his grandson, I think, who Sidney Armstrong and I both know, served as lieutenant governor of Montana, and that was the... So you may be related to them. That Cooney connection may go back to Ireland.
But it's a distant one.
Yeah.
And Mike Cooney was the youngest legislator ever elected when he was elected.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
You were born here in Helena. For some reason, I thought you were brought up in Butte.
Everybody thinks I'm a Butte girl, because that's the O'Malley side of the family.
Okay.
And maybe it's because I'm loud and rather and rather self-possessed. In any event, they then came over to the Helena area. The grandmother, Mariah Cooney, who came in that covered wagon, lived to be over 90 and is quoted in a newspaper story as saying, well, they came out over this area and Mr. Cooney found some very nice nuggets in New York Gulch, what we call York Gulch now.
Mm-hmm.
They bought land on the banks of the Missouri and had a small ranch. They raised the ordinary things. They also raised horses, quarter horses, for the cavalry
mm-hmm.
when they were out here.
Mm-hmm.
Their youngest son was my grandfather, Dr. Sidney A. Cooney, for whom I'm named.
Okay.
And he was a long time, very well regarded Helena physician.
Okay.
And he served on the Board of Health under about 8 or 9 governors. So that was my mother's family. And more about them, but we can't take the whole time on my family. My father's family, it's sort of the other side of America or Montana pioneers. My grandfather's family were also Irish immigrants. They settled on a small farm outside of St. Louis. But they made him go to Mass every day, and he got tired of walking that far. He ran away when he was 13 or 14, went to Chicago and worked for a cigar maker, and then found his way to Leadville, Colorado, where he was a miner, and where he and the other young miners used to read Shakespeare to each other every night. I thought that was something very unusual until a recent... Montana Historical Society magazine says it was quite common in the ranch house and the bunk house. Everybody had the Bible and Shakespeare. In any event, eventually my grandfather made his way to Butte, Montana, and was a miner there and a political figure and a writer also.
His name was O'Malley?
M.G. Malcolm, but called George, which was his middle name.
Mm-hmm.
He...
O'Malley.
O'Malley.
Yeah.
Yes, and he was WWW. He ran as a socialist for governor in 1904.
WWW is International Workers of
the
World.
Right, right.
And so they were considered labor radicals during his time, right?
Yep. And interestingly enough, Bob, and I'll stop going on about this, I didn't know at all about this until I was working for Jim Murray at the Montana AFL-CIO. And it occurred to me, my father had said something about, you know, your grandfather and labor and so on. So he wrote me a lengthy letter of this wonderful, wonderful history. And in fact, we have from Big Bill Haywood, who was in, we've got a blackthorn walking stick he gave to my grandfather.
Really? And Big Bill Haywood was a United Mine Workers.
And World Workers of the World, both.
Yeah, okay.
Yep.
In Idaho, I think, wasn't he?
I can't remember, but I think you're right.
Major union leader in the early part of the 1900s.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Eventually, my grandfather then became a writer. He wrote a column in the Butte newspaper called Echoes of the Past, and it was a historical column each Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. My father grew up in Butte. Have you read his book, Mile High, Mile Deep?
Yeah.
Well, that was my father.
I hadn't put that together.
Yeah. Which really is the story about growing up in Butte in the 20s and so on.
Yeah.
He went to the University of Montana, met my mother, who'd been in all-Catholic girls' school till she was doing graduate work. So they married, and my mother came to Helena to have me in the hospital.
When were you born?
1937. Long time ago.
Yeah.
In any event, they moved here, and he worked for the newspaper here.
Okay. And when did he retire about?
Well, but you see, there's much more in between.
Yeah.
Because he left during the war. He tried to enlist. He had a wonky knee or something, and he couldn't. So he ended up being an Associated Press war correspondent on the SSX Shangri-La, which was... my memory for names is just ridiculous. Tell me who I'm thinking of. John McCain. It was Admiral McCain's flagship.
Sure.
And they became very good friends.
Really?
And in fact, when Senator McCain was writing the book, Faith of Our Fathers, his assistant called and talked with Daddy several times and mentioned his name in the book several times, which I thought was very nice.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I mean, he could just say an AP reporter said this and that. So he came home and was transferred to Denver and was transferred to New York, and my parents got divorced. He went to Europe, where he was then a foreign correspondent and bureau chief in Germany, Russia, and France.
Wow.
For the next 30 years or so.
Did he retire here in Montana? I'm trying to think if I knew him.
No.
They probably wouldn't have.
No, because what they did, and he married the most wonderful woman. I had a wonderful mother and a wonderful stepmother, and my mother thought she was wonderful. Someone said, how could you like your husband's second wife? She said, why wouldn't? She's so good to my girls. And, you know, she had nothing to do with the original thing. And she was American.
Hmm.
Graduated from the University of Kansas in 1948 with a degree in aeronautical engineering.
Wow.
Eventually became a writer because they kept having her, since she was a woman, make latrine signs and so on. She was a civilian employee of the Army.
Yeah.
So they met and married. But then they took early retirement and built a house in Ireland.
Oh.
And loved living there. My father wrote most of the book in Paris. He'd go into the office at 6 a.m. And write from there. Eventually, for some health issues, they moved to Sun City.
I see.
Where she had a couple of retired relatives.
Uh-huh.
They lived there for a time.
You might have already answered this question in your commentary about your dad, but I'll ask it again. I often do in my interviews. You dedicated much, if not most, of your life to public service, and it was related to politics, too. You have an avid interest, obviously, in politics. And that may just have come from your family, I don't know. But was there, and I don't know how close you were to your father when you grew up either, because you traveled a lot apparently, but Was there a person in your life that was particularly inspirational to you in terms of your interest in politics and public service? Maybe a school teacher or a friend or a...
It was really sitting around our dining room table.
Okay, okay.
It really was. Yeah. And I just, you know, remember over the years bits and pieces of it. And it wasn't a heated political discussion every evening, mind you.
Yeah.
And I'm speaking of now of my grandfather, because then we moved into my grandfather's house when my grandmother died.
Here in Helena.
Here in Helena, right. The one thing that I remember was that they were so angry when Leif Erikson, who was from Helena and was running for Congress, and they kept accusing him of being a communist. I think it was Red Skies Over Montana or something
yeah.
like
mm-hmm.
that. I can remember several conversations when my grandfather and my mother were so angry about that. And for some reason, what sticks in my mind is my mother said, calling him a communist, she said, haven't they read The Troubled Air? And if you remember, that's Irwin Shaw's book about red baiting and all the kinds of nonsense. And it's about a radio station where the biggest anti-communist actual, or biggest anti-communist actually is a communist and
oh.
betrays all these other people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So, you know, the funny things that stick in your mind.
So you would remember Burton K. Wheeler?
I remember.
That was probably one of your early memories because Leif Erikson took him on in the Democratic
right.
primary, and
that's
that was
right.
probably where he was being called a communist or
yeah.
in the general election.
Probably. Again, that part I don't remember.
Yeah. Well, that's it.
I remember Burton K. Wheeler's book was always on our bookshelf.
Oh,
but
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there was a keen interest, but not, you know, I was involved with younger people's things at the time.
Yeah. You went to the university in Missoula, University of Montana?
Right. But before that, I went to the International School of Geneva.
Oh, really?
Well, that was my father and stepmother
sure. yeah.
decided to give both my sister and me a year in Europe. And initially, my father thought to send me high in the Alps to some sort of, you know, Swiss finishing school.
Mm-hmm.
And my wonderful stepmother said, she's been going to a co-ed school since kindergarten. You don't want to stick her up there with nothing but girls. She picked out the international school for me, which was one of the most wonderful experiences of my life.
Really?
Yes.
Wonderful opportunity.
Oh, it was so good. It was founded right after the First World War, when America didn't join the United Nations, and these were a few Americans there at the time,
mm-hmm.
one of whom was, you know, Claudia Clifford.
Yes.
One of them was her father.
Yeah. Gosh, I haven't seen her in years.
Yeah, but yeah. one of them was her father.
Yeah. Huh.
And he helped start it, and the idea was that if the youth of all nations could get to know each other and be friends, we could help prevent wars. So I went there, I lived with a Swiss family and five other girls, and that's a story in itself.
Mm-hmm.
But that certainly also opened up my mind and my interest in
when
other
would that
peoples.
Have been in the 1950s?
1954 and 1955.
Okay, and then you came home and finished college at the University of Missouri.
That wasn't college, that was my last year in high school.
I gotcha.
Yeah, so then I came home and went to the university.
Yeah, okay. How did it happen that you, because the primary purpose of this interview is your wonderful knowledge and background in the administration of Governor Tom
yes,
Judge.
Yes, let's get to that.
And so how did you come to meet Tom Judge?
Well, I knew who he was. His family had kind of moved to the neighborhood. I think while I was in late grade school, and then when I got to high school, he's a couple of years ahead of me.
Uh-huh.
And so I knew him. He was, and it was not that big. Helena High School wasn't all that big.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I knew him. And he was fun and he was nice. And he played basketball and football, not as a big star. But
mm-hmm.
I remember him most vividly in terms of high school when he and his two best pals, Clint Grimes and Paul Jasmine, were in Arsenic and Old Lace.
Oh, my.
And he played Teddy Roosevelt. Anyway, he was just grand. And then the next year, I was a junior, and I was about to go to Switzerland the following year. I started dating one of his best friends, Paul Jasmine. And pretty soon, we just had a great group of good friends.
Is he a brother of Ed Jasmine?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
The younger brother,
I
exactly
know the family,
right.
Yeah, you bet.
And he has ended up, you know, being a splendid artist and photographer and so on.
Okay.
But In any event, that was how I first got to know Tom Judge. And I married him in college. We had our first baby spring vacation junior year. None of this, God knows, was planned. The second baby 6 weeks after we graduated. And then we moved to Helena. My former husband was a geologist, and it was just when they really didn't need geologists. So he went to work for the highway department, drawing maps from aerial photographs. But anyhow, Tom called me one day. He'd gone to Notre Dame, and then he'd worked for a company in St. Louis and so forth. And he came home and decided to run for the legislature.
Okay.
And he called me one day and told me, I said, well, that just sounded great. And he said, would you be the secretary of my Tom Judge for Legislature campaign and committee? I said, oh, I would love to, Tom, but I can't type. And he started to laugh, just as you have. And he said, no, it isn't that kind of secretary. He said, I would just love to have your name on my material. You know, you've been a good friend, you know everybody in town. And he said, would you do some volunteer work? I said, well, of course, I'd be glad to. But then we moved to California for a brief year for what looked like a good opportunity for my former husband. Turned out not to be. But we thought we'd have to stay there because there didn't seem to be anything here. We came back, must have been 62 we came back, can't remember exactly. And he went out to visit his old pals at the highway department, and they said, there's a new job for a state geologist. He applied, we never even went back to pack up our things. My sister went and supervised the moving company.
Well, that's good, that's a wonderful story. So you're back here in Helena, and your husband has a job, and you reconnected with Tom Judge,
right?
You're involved in his campaign for the State House of Representatives in 1962.
So then my friend Sue Bennett called me, and I didn't know her well, but she was one of the big girls in the neighborhood that we all looked up to. She went to Hawthorne and Helena High School and so on. She called and said, there's a meeting of Democratic Women's Club tonight. I think you'd enjoy joining and getting to know some of these women. I had been so lonesome in the suburb we lived in California. I knew no one. We went nowhere. Husband had to take the car to work every day, etc. I think if she'd asked me to join a group to teach knitting, even if I didn't know how to, I would have joined. I joined the Democratic Women's Club. And that was where, with that and Tom's first campaign, that's where I really got active, Bob.
And then you were, of course, involved in Tom Judge's campaigns for the legislature again, for the state senate, so on.
Yes.
What do you suppose motivated him to run for lieutenant governor?
I think he saw it as a path to governor.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he was obviously ambitious.
He was, yeah. And I don't think when he really started out that first time that he necessarily was projecting it that far. But he became so involved and so interested. And you remember what an we probably were 2 years old, but it was such an exciting time in Montana. The new constitution for which he campaigned, and everything that was going on, and the people involved, and this whole new, we're moving Montana forward in this progressive way.
And so he ran not as a team, because the constitution didn't require that then.
Precisely.
He ran for lieutenant governor when Forrest Anderson ran for governor.
Precisely.
Do you know anything about that relationship?
I think it was not a close relationship, but they did work pretty well together. And that's about all I really, I do remember. This was when, the minute the governor walked out of the state, the lieutenant governor took over.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the first time Forrest left, Tom was going to be governor. And so the woman who'd been his secretary in the campaign and somewhere else, can't remember what all, he invited us to come up and see him. And Gene Handel, we all know dear Gene Handel, of course, continued as Forrest's executive secretary.
Okay. Yes.
So we came prancing in the office and we had champagne and, And we went in to see Tom and we took pictures and Walter Marshall came in.
The ever-present Walter
exactly.
Marshall.
Exactly. But he called whatever station that Chet Huntley worked for, mm-hmm. okay? He called Chet. He said, Tom, I think Chet Huntley would like to talk with you. Let me see if I can't get him on the phone. Oh, by God, he got him on the phone, Bob. And Chet Huntley told Tom about starting Big Sky.
Yeah.
So we thought, well, we were kind of in early on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right. And of course, Chet Huntley had roots in Montana.
Oh, Lord, yes.
National NBC news broadcast.
We loved him.
Yeah.
He was one of our guys.
Yeah.
So let me circle back briefly, though, to the Lieutenant Governor campaign, because it sort of, I feel, is such a flavor of Montana at the time. We didn't have a whole bunch of money, and most people didn't really know young Tom Judge, who'd been a legislator. However, the two biggest connections that helped him the most, he was very active in JC's.
Okay.
The Junior Chamber of Commerce, which I never hear about mm-hmm. anymore.
I don't even know if it exists
anymore. I don't think it probably does. But the JC's, they were also younger and at least progressive, and we want to make some changes. And Blanche Judge's relationships through her dance studio.
Okay. She and Blanche Judge was Tom Judge's
was Tom's mother.
Mother,
and his father had died. He'd fallen off a roof when I think Tom was going to Notre Dame. Hmm. And that was when Blanche really got busy and opened the dance and exercise studio and worked very hard and was very dynamic, very beautiful, very outgoing. And so she would call, she would say, we don't have anybody in Malta. I think I met a woman there at a dance conference last year. Let me see. So she'd call somebody and be so gracious and lovely. This would be somebody who'd never been involved in politics, mm-hmm. Bob. Would you help my son? Well, pretty soon we had all kinds of people scattered throughout the state who'd never been involved in politics before.
Mm-hmm.
And we campaigned all over the state. We sang on street corners and in union halls. And we had a sound truck that came with us. And that was in the days of Laugh In when
yeah.
Sammy Davis Jr. did that part with, here come the judge, here come the judge, right?
Yeah.
Well, people started saying that.
Because of Tom Judge.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So, the sound truck, here come Tom Judge, here come the judge for Lieutenant Governor, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a great campaign.
He campaigned hard and smart.
Oh, yes. And it was all very, very personal.
Mm-hmm.
Very personal.
And he was personable with
he
people.
He was very personable with people. And of course, Carol, that I do want to talk almost a little more than Tom, because so many people remember Tom and have given you information.
Yeah.
But she was incredibly good.
Carol, his wife.
Oh, yes. And of course, she was the younger sister of Larry's wife, Sherry, who was my best friend and college roommate.
Yeah. Larry Pettit.
Yes.
And Tom Judge, married sisters.
Right.
Carol
right.
and Sherry Anderson, I
right.
think.
Right. That's yeah. exactly right.
But Judge's wife was Carol.
Was Carol, the younger,
yeah.
the younger one.
Okay.
And her parents then, who used to come to parties at the governor's mansion, as we called it in those, I guess they still do, said, we had no idea Democrats had so much fun. But again, it was very down home, very people to people and so forth and so on. And so that primary election was very good. The only thing that wasn't so good was his grandfather, who was kind of a wacko.
Whose was?
Tom's, his mother's mother, Mr. Gillott.
His mother's father?
Yes.
Yeah.
Came out and said he'd given Tom a loan that hadn't been repaid. And so the newspaper headline was, here come to Grandpa. Well, it wasn't funny, believe me, but we did get through that. We did get through that.
Wow.
So that was the primary, and then again, and he loved that, because of course he presided over the Senate.
Sure.
I mean, he loved, many people who have known him in both roles more intimately than I say, he really was a better legislator than he was a governor. Yeah. And they thought he was a good governor, but they felt that's where his real talent was.
Yeah, because he was so good at facilitating between people.
Precisely.
And that sort of thing.
And liked him.
And liked him.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So he served as lieutenant governor for 4 years.
Yes.
And of course, you knew him during that period of time.
Oh, yes.
Closely. And then he decided to run for governor. Did that come as a surprise to you?
No, not really.
And Governor Anderson had health problems, so it was pretty clear he wasn't
going to run. Well, I was going to say, that was, yeah. I don't think he would have run against Forrest.
Sure, yeah.
But, I mean, it had opened up an opportunity.
Do you know if Forrest supported Tom in the primary for governor?
I don't remember. Did you ask Larry that?
Yeah, he didn't.
He didn't remember either.
Yeah.
I think he, to be, the only thing I really remember is I think he kept kind of a hands-off of a Democratic primary,
yeah.
which
yeah.
was appropriate, yeah. obviously.
If he did, it wasn't obvious
no.
and openly.
No.
How about his primary opponent was a guy by the name of Dick DeZeevy.
Dick DeZeevy.
D-Z-I-V-I. Yeah. What about him? What about that race?
People said he was kind of a crook. I have no idea any truth to that. He campaigned, but he didn't do it the way we were.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they ever debated. You had mentioned you wanted yeah. to know about that.
Yeah.
I have no recollection that they ever debated.
He had a reputation as a kind of a tough guy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. He grew up in Kalispell, my hometown, I think.
Oh, I didn't know that, because he was in Great Falls when he ran against
us. He was elected to the state Senate from Great Falls, and he became the Senate Majority Leader.
Mm-hmm.
But as I remember, I was just a young legislator during that period of time. In fact, I'm not sure I was in the legislature,
yeah.
but I was there soon enough afterwards
sure.
that I remember Dick DeZeevy had a reputation that, you know, you better not cross him.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely. But we didn't have any trouble with him.
The primary went okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Tom Judge won it by a pretty substantial
yes,
margin.
Yes, as I recall.
Yeah.
As I recall.
And then his opponent in the general election was Big Ed Smith.
Right.
Tell
right.
me about that.
Well, we conducted a fairly similar campaign, except there was more money, more media, all those kinds of things. But the thing that always kind of tickled me was that Tom began to wear sort of Western cut and style suits, and Big Ed Smith started to dress in sort of navy blue button-down collars.
Because Big Ed was a rough
hewn. Was a rancher, you
Montana
bet.
Montana rancher and farmer.
And who was this pretty boy?
And Tom Judge was the refined, cultivated.
Yes.
And so Tom realized he needed to be a little more like Ed, and Ed realized he needed
and
to be a little
versa.
More like Tom.
And vice versa.
Yeah. That's interesting.
But that first campaign had set the stage. That's how we campaigned. And Carol was a tremendous campaigner. Just tremendous. And she and I also went out on kind of more short-term
yeah.
kinds of things.
Was Blanche in the picture then, when he ran for governor?
Oh, my word. We could do a novel about that whole arrangement. And Larry, I'm sure, touched on it.
He did.
Or fell down and screamed about it. Blanche had been Tom's campaign manager each campaign. But there wasn't a whole lot, well, I shouldn't say that. She did an awful lot of getting people involved.
Mm-hmm. Calling old connections.
And excited and encouraged and building a network and having them all come and here we all are and we love you and so on. She had no particular knowledge of any kind of campaign strategy, didn't know a lot about a lot of issues. And she, I don't mean just by that, to say she was ignorant or ill-informed.
Mm-hmm.
She was not. But her experience had never been with a statewide, high-level campaign. And especially major donors weren't terribly interested in having this sort of blonde bombshell as the campaign manager.
So Blanche Judge was an attractive blonde woman?
Oh, very attractive.
Okay.
Very, very attractive. Beautiful, beautiful. She really was. With a very vibrant and outgoing personality and more energy than six people put together, which Tom was too. And so it had all gone very well until the governor's campaign. And then I think a lot of people advised him, you know, you really can't let your mother run this major campaign. So, through a series of things, Tom asked Larry Pettit.
And Larry, by then, was his brother-in-law?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
And Larry was a very cerebral...
Oh, yes. Yeah,
brilliant.
Brilliant!
Political science PhD, I think, and yeah.
Oh, yes.
And had worked back in Washington, D.C. for Senator Metcalf and Senator Murray.
Precisely.
And so he was a, if you could find a competent, smart guy to help run your campaign with some important background experience, you couldn't do much better than Larry Pettit.
Especially when he was a guy that came from a modest background in Lewistown
yeah.
and went to the University of Montana. He wasn't importing some big hotshot
yeah,
from out
yeah,
of state.
Yeah.
So he had the brilliance, but he also had that grassroots knowledge mm-hmm. and understanding. Yeah.
But that's going to create trouble with Tom's Ooh. Mother.
Oh! Yeah. I never want to live through anything like that again. And Larry will tell the story. Maybe he told it to you that when he came into the office, Blanche was quite gracious. She was so good to So good to see you, Larry. I'd like you to work on some education issues for Tom. And yes, he sort of said, I believe I'm going to manage the campaign. It was a terrible blow-up. It was really a terrible blow-up. And Blanche left and screamed and yelled and, you know, told all her friends how terrible Tom was. And yeah, it was pretty tough. But we did get through the primary, as you know. But then an interesting thing occurred, which I think few other people may think to mention. Tom had won the primary, but one of the ways he had won it was somebody told him, if you want to win Cascade County, you got to get Jack so-and-so, and I can't think of his last name, bless him, may come to you. You got to get so-and-so. He is...
Jack Devine?
No, I'd remember that. Okay. In any event, I may remember it, I may not, may have to call you.
Okay.
In any event, Jack was very active in the Catholic Church's Curcio movement, which was a retreat unlike any other kind because it was full of joy and music and, you know, otherwise they were silent. I hated them worse than anything. Anyway, Jack said, well, Lieutenant Governor, I will manage your campaign in Cascade County. I will win it for you. If you promise to go to the first Curcio that is held after you win.
Hmm.
Well, of course, Tom was, you know, promise him anything. Sure, that sounds fine. I'm a Catholic. Yeah, fine. So, won the election, and I think the Democratic conference or convention was the next week, maybe 2 weeks later. It was at the same time as the next Curcio to be held in Great Falls. And Tom said, well, I can't go, Jack.
Yeah.
I'm head of the party. Jack said, a promise is a promise,
oh,
Governor.
No.
So he and Kent Kleinkopf, his, you know, by that time, great friend who'd done the driving and been his, you know, steadfast ally and so on.
With to Governor Judge.
Yes.
Yeah. And
well, during the campaign, Lieutenant Governor.
Suffered some from the wrath of the governor's
oh,
mother,
God,
too.
Yes. Yeah, I didn't even get into that, but you're so right. But in any event, they both went. And you never, I saw them off from the house, and you never saw two such angry faces in your life. So they went off Thursday night.
Who was angry? No.
Well, Tom and Kent, because they
Kent.
Had to go to this blankety-blank Curcio business.
Gotcha. Okay.
Well, so they went to this blankety-blank Curcio business, and they came back the most joyful, happy people you ever met. And Tom immediately had an impromptu party at his mother's house with people playing guitars, and he had the song sheets from the Curcio, and we all sang and laughed, and oh my goodness, we had such a grand time. So that didn't turn out so badly. Also because there was lots of infighting at the convention. He didn't have to take sides. I mean, it was really, oh, thank you, Lord.
So the God was with
him. Jack Whitaker, that's who it
okay,
was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, exactly. So then we went on about, you know, the general election.
Yeah.
And obviously won, I'm trying to
that's
think.
That's Big Ed Smith.
Yeah, Big Ed Smith. But again, this was very down home, down to earth. I mean, I remember, and this usually included Carol, I mean, we'd campaign at plant gates in the morning and finish up at bowling alleys at 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
But it was all that very personal, people to people.
And Carol was with him through all of that because
oh, yeah.
he had a reputation as a real hard worker, a real hard
campaigner. Oh, absolutely.
And a quite a good campaigner.
Yes. Oh, yeah, nothing. I mean, we'd be, you know, having we'd be having dinner at 9 o'clock at night, and he'd say, I think we can still make it to the bowling alley, and we've got the smelter opening, you know, whatever. And
yeah.
we were like, okay,
yeah.
we'll all go.
Yeah.
And most of us were volunteers.
And he was a natural glad-hander and a good conversationalist.
And enjoyed people.
Yeah.
I mean, he genuinely enjoyed meeting and talking to them and so forth and so on. So, and Carol and I'd get sent out to some of the things, and that was fine, too. We had a very good time together. And Blanche continued to not be so terrible because she'd been to the Curcio. Because then Carol and Blanche went to the next women's Curcio.
Okay.
Blanche came up to me at the Placer Hotel. It was some sort of Democratic event, and apologized to me because she got very mad at me over some things and screamed and yelled and so forth and so on.
So that maybe didn't turn out that bad for everybody.
Well, even better than that, and I'd love to have some way to get this really put together. Other people in the administration and in the governor's office began to make Curcios too. I did, Evan Barrett did, four or five other people did. And then after the Curcio, the idea was you didn't just say, well, that was so great, and that you'd meet once a week, and usually with the people with whom you'd made the Curcio itself. Well, we couldn't do that. I mean, they'd gone to in Missoula or Great Falls, somebody else. Evan went in the prison, Bob, just before there was going to be a riot.
Evan Barrett?
And Duke Crowley begged him not to go. And Evan said, well, they won't know. And so he made his Curcio in the prison.
How does this Curcio thing work? Aren't there Catholic priests involved and things like that?
There's usually one, but most of it is lay-led.
So he took his group to the state
penitentiary? He didn't take a group.
Oh.
The Curcio planned a Curcio in the prison for the prisoners.
For the prisoner people. And he knew about that, so he just joined in.
Yes, and he was allowed to do that.
Okay.
And he said to Duke, nobody will know who I am.
Duke Crowley was a professor at the University
of Right, and then he'd worked in the administration for a time.
Yeah, worked for Forrest Anderson for a while.
Yeah, exactly. He lived here in Helen.
Yeah.
Evan said the first time he got there, the first night, some big guy walked over to him and said, I know who you are. But again, the whole experience, 4 days, was wonderful. The warden used to say, Bob, there were only two things he saw that ever really worked in the prison in terms of changing people, was AA and the Curcio.
I'll be darned,
So we had a little group that when we were in town, Wednesday lunch, we'd meet in the lower level of St. Mary's Church, bring our lunch, and have a little prayer time and share time together. Well, that makes quite a difference in the ambience of an office.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us were good friends anyway, but this certainly helped solidify
it. Was an additional bond.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely.
Yeah. And that helped the Tom Judge administration to be a coordinated administration.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And who was the chief of staff? Was it
Ron started.
Ron Richards.
Yeah. And then Keith Colbow came in.
Okay.
And he was great. I really
Both
liked him.
Both of them were highly capable.
Oh,
in fact,
so
Colbow
capable.
Was, I think, in the Babcock administration, too. Wasn't
I think he was.
Yeah.
I think he told me that once.
Yeah.
I was very fond of Keith.
And he went on to be a lobbyist later on after the Tom Judge administration. He might have stuck around with Schwinden, too, for all I know. But I remember him as a very smart, very shrewd, very hardworking
and very quiet, very unself-promotional.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I really liked him.
But very effective, and you always knew you were talking to somebody who was really sharp and really competent.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That does bring up a funny thing, though, I'd kind of forgotten. The Masons put out some kind of a newsletter, and that was when there was a lot of, you know, animosity between Catholics and Masons, mm-hmm. which I think, thankfully, has dissipated. But they put out a newsletter about how many Catholics Tom had hired in his administration. Oh. Well, of course, he didn't know who was a Catholic and who wasn't. I mean, he knew I was. He'd known me for a long time. Uh-huh. So he's talking to me about it. And I said, well, you know, quite a few of us. Well, he said, Keith Kolbo? I said, well, he's a German Catholic governor. He said, well, what about Kathy Schillinger? I said, she's a German Catholic. I mean, he sort of thought if he didn't have an Irish name, you likely weren't a Catholic. Yeah. And there were quite a few of us. But again, he never hired us because we were Catholics, as you can imagine. So to me, what also kind of sets the stage for not like other administrations, Tom and Carol had no money by the end of that election. He had his business, right? Mm-hmm. Well, he hadn't been able to do beans with his business, et cetera, et cetera. Carol wasn't working.
Yeah.
They had two little children.
Yeah.
And they had to move into the governor's mansion. And it was before Christmas, as I recall. I think Forrest and Evelyn kindly moved out and had a little meeting with Carol and me, telling us to be sure to never answer the door in our jeans. and other nice things. I liked Evelyn a lot, too. They didn't have the money to move. But Tom had an old school friend who was a driver for Mayflower. And he was able to borrow the Mayflower truck and the big packing boxes for things. And so we all gathered round one day, and we didn't move much furniture because, of course, the mansion mm-hmm. was furnished. But all their other things and the kid things, mm-hmm. we spent an entire day packing them up, getting them over, and unpacking them and putting them away. So that was the start of his administration. Mm-hmm. That evening, Carol and Hazel, Carol's parents, brought over a whole bunch of fried chicken. I think it was probably Kentucky Fried Chicken and salad and beans and cake and so on. And we were eating downstairs in what was kind of like a big recreation room, mm-hmm. right?
In the governor's mansion.
Yep. 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 And we hadn't even got everything put away yet. we worked, Bob. But this is something I remember so clearly and which moved me at the time so much. Tom and I are sitting next to each other, you know, in rumpled jeans and greasy fingers and so on. And we talked a little bit, oh my gosh, you know, sort of, did you ever think we'd make it here? Isn't it wonderful? And Tom said, you know the kind of governor I want to be? I want to be the kind of governor that Lee Metcalf is as a senator.
Really?
You do what's right, whether people are going to like it or not.
Really?
And I just felt so positive and so good about that.
And also that Metcalf was such a solid role model.
Oh, totally. And you know, he was a longtime family friend.
Yeah.
He used to live with them when he was in the legislature.
His name was Thomas Lee Judge.
Precisely.
Yeah. And so Tom Judge was his middle name was Lee.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But that really moved me. And the very first dinner he held at the governor's mansion were the people who moved him in.
Wow.
Yeah. The old high school buddy that drove truck for Mayflower and some other folks and friends and, yeah.
Well, that tells something about the kind of person.
Precisely.
Yeah, you bet.
Precisely. Exactly.
Did you have a role then, an official role in the administration when he was governor?
Oh, yes, but it took a while. I started out being a half-time social secretary. I worked with Carol, and I was responsible for all the formal things that went on at the entertaining and so on that went on at the governor's mansion. And there were a lot in those days.
Did you bring in legislators, for example, for dinners and that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember any key legislators that were
You know, I don't. What did Larry say? I meant to ask him because it would trigger my memory, but don't worry about it.
He said the Butte delegation.
Yes, that I do remember.
And Francis Bardineau,
I was just going to say the one I do remember is Francis Bardineau. Yeah. Yeah. But there was lots of entertaining, and of course, it was right around the inaugural ball. So I was helping with that and the reception before and so forth and so on. Half-time, except I worked full-time for about the first 6 months. And then so Carol said, well, now take the summer off. You know, we're not doing it. I did help from time to time. But then something I thought I was going to be doing sort of fell through. And I said, Carol, I'm going to need a full-time job. I have children and so forth. I'd just gotten divorced. And so she talked with Tom, and he said, well, yeah, tell her to come on in the office. And, you know, I knew the
people.
We'll
figure out something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he forgot to tell Ron Richards that, or Gene Handel. So I was a little upset about the thing that I thought was going to happen. Hadn't. It wasn't my happiest time. So I came in one morning in the fall, and Gene said, whoops, Sid, hi, how are you doing? You got some work from Carol you want us to do? Because people type things at the office for us. I said, well, no, I'm supposed to come and work here. And she said, oh, well, I don't think I knew about that. Let me go ask Ron. So she went back and asked Ron, and obviously he said pretty much the same thing. And she came out and she said, well, there's an office down the hall. We'll get you a typewriter and a desk. What is it you're going to be doing? And I said, well, I'll keep on with my work, you know, at the governor's mansion and with Carol. But then Tom thought it would be good maybe if I really paid attention to the people that were his old friends and newer ones and wrote, you know, read the newspapers, wrote sympathy letters, okay, all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they all kind of went, okay, you know, that's what the governor wants. Well, sure. And so there I was trying to type a sympathy letter. And I think I ruined more beautiful stationery than whatever I was getting paid. And Keith Colbow was coming over for the legislature. And he came over, there was an inner office. Gracious, he said, I just don't want to disturb you. I'll probably be having to go in and out, and I'll do my best. You know, I mean, couldn't have been nicer about it.
Yeah.
And then a young woman named Joyce Andrus, if you remember her at all.
I do.
Well, she came over, I think she just graduated from a year of secretarial school. She's about 19. And she and I just hit it off. And she'd see me, and she'd say, Sid, I could type that up for you. Well, pretty soon she started typing up, and I wrote a pretty good letter. And Tom would be all tickled about, oh, I really like the letter you wrote about thus and such. So that all helped a whole lot.
Yeah.
I began to help Kent with appointments. I began to help in other areas of the office. And of course, it was also during the whole thing of deinstitutionalization. And that was a place where Carol just shone.
Yeah. She had a personal interest in that.
Oh, absolutely.
And to make sure people might understand what we're talking about here. We had state administrations at Boulder and Warm Springs, I think those for sure. And that's where people who had cognitive problems, mental problems, or psychological problems, they were at one place or the other. And it was said at the time by critics that that Boulder and Warm Springs, those institutions, were human warehouses.
Oh, that's too kind.
People were treated well. They were just sent there sometimes by family members who didn't know what to do with them and just wanted to.
And often a doctor would say, I know this from a relative, excuse me, well, this all came up during the first legislature, and what the workers at those institutions wanted was more money.
Sure,
and they wanted
to
more
keep their jobs.
And they wanted more people hired. I mean, there was no way, and I don't care how good they were, and a lot of them were very, very good, but they just had way too much, and it was just, so we toured the institutions. Well, Carol, as a nurse getting her degree, had spent 3 months in a practicum at Warm Springs. I mean, she really knew what was going on. And we toured Boulder, and I mean, I never saw anything so awful. But again, people would come, the workers would come up to us and say, we hate that it's like this, please help us. We don't want it to be like this either. So they went.
It was unclean and disorganized.
Oh, God. And the developmentally disabled would be sitting in a dirty shirt, banging their head against the wall. And, well, it was, you know, it was truly bedlam in the old sense of the word. Mm-hmm. Well, then they went on strike. And it was the best thing that ever happened. Had to call in the National Guard. And the National Guard from all over the state saw how terrible it was. And they just raised all kinds of hell and told their legislators, you got to do something about this.
Yeah.
And we got to make some changes anyway. It was at a time where we were looking more at group homes and deinstitutionalization and so on in any event. So that got started. Carol developed a brochure about Boulder and Warm Springs that we got printed and pictures in it, worked up and gave it to the legislators. Long story short, they did raise it, and we did begin to move in the direction of deinstitutionalization. Carol played a very important role in that, and Tom really listened to her as well. Mm-hmm. He refused to take part of his salary that year if they didn't raise the pay for those workers, and the state said, no, that's against the law. You can't give that back. That'd be like somebody saying, I'll work for less than the other fella. So he gave it to Carol and me. Yep. And what we did was ask at the institutions, what do people most need for Christmas?
Huh.
And we would do that. Huh. So then moving on with that.
Well, that was a good story, what you just told me.
Well, good.
Yeah, you bet.
But wait, there's more.
Okay.
I don't want to keep you all night. So then they started opening group homes and community-based facilities and so on. Well, there was a lot of nut in my backyard, as you can imagine.
Right.
But these houses were very nice. They were clean. The people were people, you know, that could be there. Mm-hmm. And they would have an opening tea and invite Carol.
The governor's wife.
You bet, yeah. The first lady. And keep in mind, too, Bob, people looked at Tom and Carol the way they used to look at Jack and Jackie Kennedy. They were sort of these beautiful, wonderful, handsome people who also cared about sort of ordinary people. They were really kind of put on the pedestal. So Carol and I would go to the openings and the teas at these homes. And that, again, was the most beautiful and wonderful and almost miraculous kind of experiences. We would see people we had literally seen 6 months before in dirty clothes, banging their head against the wall, now talking to you, wanting to show you their bowling ball, and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it became much more acceptable. The First Lady was there. The First Lady invites you to come to this. It made a huge difference. Huge difference
kind of
in people's
positive
life.
Difference in people's lives.
Precisely the point.
Yeah.
Precisely the point.
And that's still pretty much the case today.
Yes.
I mean, I think there are still institutions, but they're not a shadow of what they once were.
Mm-mm. Not at all. And there was one group home in Great Falls that was almost all elderly people mm-hmm. that had spent most of their life there. I talked for quite a while with one just lovely older woman. Her mother had died when she was young. Her father worked on the railroad. The nuns had her for a time, but she kept running away trying to find her mother and father.
Oh, dear.
So they put her, they didn't know what else to do with her. So they put her there. She wasn't even mentally disabled. So we saw some of that too.
Oh dear.
Yeah, but again, how wonderful. She was so happy, she had a lovely room, showed it to me, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the most rewarding parts of my working for the governor were those positive changes in people's lives.
Which he strongly approved of and probably tried to
he was the leader of it.
Facilitate and was the leader of.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what else?
Well, that's going on in his first term.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And his lieutenant governor was a guy named Bill Christensen.
Yes.
And I wondered, since the 1972 Constitution required that governors and lieutenant governors run as a team, well, Christensen and Judge hadn't run as a team.
That's...
They happened to both be Democrats, but they were elected independently.
Yeah.
Well, was there some reason or other that Judge didn't ask Christensen to be his running mate when he ran again in 1976? I thought there was something unusual about that. Maybe
There was, but by this time, by 1976, there was the whole supposedly missing $96,000 that supposedly had not been reported, and then the rumor was Tom had pocketed it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now keep in mind, Bob, I signed all those formal reports. I had never worked on one of them. Initially, it was the woman in his office, his advertising office, and Blanche gave her all the, you know, checks and the people and their occupations, and we, and so somebody would bring it to me and I would sign it. Never so much as dotted an I, except on my name.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it took a while to get the governor's one, because we had, it was wonderful. I remember Cale Jackson came running over from the Capitol. I was at the governor's mansion doing something. And he said, oh my gosh, we're already late with this. Will you sign it? And I said, oh, look how much we raised. Isn't this great? But I was the one, should it be proven it had been mismanaged and misreported. For anybody else, it was a misdemeanor. For me, it was a felony.
Holy
shit. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Well, I got a lot of jokes about the chocolate cake they were going to bring me with a file in it, which I didn't, frankly, feel so terribly amused by. Woodall called a grand jury.
The Attorney General.
Yeah, the Attorney General.
Bob Woodall.
Well, against whom we were running.
Yeah, yeah. He was emerging as the Republican candidate.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And his office was just down the hall.
Yeah.
I mean, we were kind of pals with his people. They were nice people.
At that time, the governor's office and the Attorney General's office were in the same relatively small hallway.
Oh, yeah.
In the Capitol.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. So they impaneled the grand jury. Timer Moses came as our attorney, because there was some money left over, but it was properly in a savings account under my name. And we did use that, again, properly, to pay Timer, who was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And prominent trial attorney.
Oh, Billings. Lord, yes. But a lot of people thought if you got Timer, you must be guilty. You know.
Yeah, you did.
But in any event, after he spent time with me, and we did become friends too, he realized that I had not, no, the grand jury didn't even call me, because I had nothing to do with the actual preparation or handling or reporting of any of the money. And, you know, at last, Tom was exonerated. It was proved he hadn't taken anything. But at the same time, he was at Big Sky a lot. And,
ski resort.
Yeah. And we'd been down there when they were selling condos and this and that, and Tom bought one. And then he was had been, one of the things he did in high school was he was a great leader in skiing, which was not a big sport then.
Mm-hmm.
Skied up on McDonald Pass, as I recall. But in any event, so he would go down there and have a great ski weekend and so on. So then they started writing stories about how he acted up at one of the restaurant bars down at the bottom of the hill of Big Sky, and he threw a potato at somebody and so forth. So I think Bill just, he was still worried about the money. He didn't like, you know, those kinds of stories. So I think more than Tom not picking him, I think he kind of said, this isn't my ball game.
I got you.
Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah.
He just kind of thought, I think I won't continue.
That's my impression and recollection.
Okay.
Did Tom ever sit down and say that to me in so many words? No. But meanwhile, and again, Carol was becoming more prominent. We went to all the governor's conferences, and I got to go to the first lady lunches with her. And most of them were kind of like the governor's were. Who were mostly three-piece suit, gray hair, shiny shoes, and most of their wives, who were lovely and often did some very good things, but they were sort of bouffant white hairdos and so forth. But there were some, we would sit with Kitty Dukakis and Dolly Lamb, who were also, Dottie Lamb, who were also younger and doing some really interesting kinds
Donnie
of
Lamb
things.
Was the governor of the, or the wife of the governor of Colorado.
And Kitty Dukakis was the wife of the governor of Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And those were two of our great favorites. I also liked some of the older ones. I especially enjoyed Mrs. Lucy from Wisconsin, as I recall.
Okay.
Yeah. And in fact, his sister was a nun who worked in the Kalispell schools for a time, Bob.
Really?
Yes. Huh. I don't recall her name, but there was a big argument over the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yeah.
And the first ladies voted it down. The governors had already voted for it.
I didn't know that.
And I said, and you know, I mean, I called Dottie Lamb Dottie, but I mean, of course, mm-hmm. I said, Mrs. Lucy, I said, for heaven's sakes, how is it that the first ladies voted it down when the governors were in favor of it? And she looked at me, and she's quite elegant. She said, Sydney, they're just chicken shit. Oh my goodness.
Well, that was quite an experience that you had then.
Oh,
you know, in the judge administration.
Exactly. I got to meet so many interesting people.
Was Schwinden coming to the surface at all during that time? He had a job on judge's cabinet.
Well, he was in state lands.
Yeah.
But Forrest had appointed him.
Yeah.
And I think he did a very good job in state lands.
Yeah.
And then became Tom's lieutenant governor. And we all thought the world of him.
That was my next question. Obviously, he'd proven himself as a pretty valuable member of the team.
Precisely.
In the judge's first term in office. And he surfaced positively. And with Christensen out of the picture, judge needed to choose somebody. And I thought this too. In fact, I think Bruce mentioned this, or not Bruce, but Larry mentioned this in our interview, that it wasn't lost on Tom Judge that Ed Smith really had a foot in the agricultural camp.
Precisely. You're exactly right.
Okay, and so Ted Schwinden did too.
Precisely.
So
he had all that good government experience
a real good combination. He'd served in the legislature before. The farmers and ranchers considered him one of theirs. He was a very competent bureaucrat. And so that's how he emerged.
And a hell of a good guy.
Able to make friends and shake hands and so on. So
exactly.
So Judge chose him to be his running mate.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And
exactly.
Then you were still there during the second administration.
Right. And by that time, and I'd done, you know, a dozen different things, but by that time I began to work primarily on appointments to boards, commissions, and advisory councils. And I'd been working on it a lot because Kent had the grand jury, and I mean, he was...
Kent Kleinkopf.
Kleinkopf, because he traveled with the governor, all those kinds of things.
Still traveled with the governor.
Yeah, yeah. So I began to work on appointments to boards, commissions, and advisory councils. And oh, that was so good and so exciting. Because once again, traditionally, it had been older men appointed to all the major boards. Women were appointed to the board of cosmetologists and the board of nurses. And there weren't a lot of Native Americans. And Tom really wanted to see both of those expanded.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we ever got an exact grip on it, but I think it was about 12% women when we started, and by the time we left, it was about 35% women.
Well, that's significant.
Yes, and there were women on every major board, as I recall, and some of them were chairs. Rita Sheehy.
Yeah.
Exactly, and she was so wonderful.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these weren't token, I want to say, in any sense of the word. They were marvelous. And again, we were beginning to have women come in as higher up positions. I started as a secretary because no one knew what else to do with me. And then finally, it was Evan and Bruce Nelson and Blake Wardell and so on who said...
Evan Barrett.
Oh, Evan, my God, yes, my friend. He and I started working on Tom's campaigns the first year he was here as a teacher in 1968.
Hmm.
And he came to volunteer, and he told the people in his social science or history class or whatever, he'd give them extra credit if they'd work on a campaign. Hmm. They'd volunteer.
Hmm.
So they all came and said, this is ridiculous. You're doing everything we do. Go tell Keith you want a raise and a different title.
Keith.
Kobo.
Okay.
Okay. Well, kind of like that. I didn't want to. They made me. So I went in and talked with Keith about it, and he said, oh, you know, you're just doing a grand job, but you know what holds you back? You don't have a college degree. I said, Keith, I graduated from college with honors. Well, he said, you couldn't have. You had all those little children then.
What?
I said, yeah, but I kept going to school.
That'd be the easiest thing in the world to check on.
Well, but what he said, and this wasn't his fault, he said, I've never seen your resume. Well, I'd never been asked for one.
Yeah.
So once we got that all straightened around, then, you know, I began to have a title and salary like the big boys. But it was the big boys who made me do it.
Hmm. Wow.
Or the younger ones. There was a bill, Senate Bill 80. It was for coalition bargaining instead of collective bargaining. And I don't even remember if I understood the issue that well, but I knew who my pals were for. Jim Murray and Don Judge. And by that time, I had a big office at the end of the hall that Keith had had when I was sitting out there trying to type. And they'd always bring their coats in the office.
And Don Judge and Jim Murray,
yeah,
were the leaders of the AFL-CIO.
Jim was the leader, and Don was the COPE leader.
Okay.
Yeah.
Committee on Political Education.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So in any event, Tom was going to sign the legislation. And he'd been meeting with Francis, I think, and with the banker from up around Darby, Hamilton.
Bill Gruff.
There you go, Bill Gruff and so on. He was going to sign it. Well, Bruce and Blake and I were just in arms, and we had a chance to go in and argue with Tom about it. And he ended up not signing it.
Hmm.
So they said, the women and children saved the day. Meanwhile, Carol had also gone for alcoholism treatment.
Oh, dear.
She felt she was having some issues, and I feel free to say it now because eventually she did too. And she told me what I call Kay Flynn, who was Kay Flynn Hanrahan in those days.
The county attorney's wife?
Right, yep. And she was originally old-time Montana Butte Helena family. Mm-hmm. She'd moved with Tom to Glendive after he lost the attorney general.
Yeah.
Okay.
Tom
and
Hanrahan. Yep.
Yeah. And she had gone to Hartview because she had the problem and then become a counselor. So Carol said to me one day, I want to go to Hartview. Will you call Kay?
And Hartview.
Yep. It's the most wonderful place.
Where is it?
North Dakota.
Okay.
Maybe it's south. I get them mixed up.
Uh-huh.
So I said, sure. So I called Kay, and Kay said, no, she has to call and ask me herself. So Carol called and asked Kay. Mm-hmm. Kay drove up from Glendive to pick her up. And Tom was out of town. And so she got to Hartview and was there maybe 5 weeks, maybe six.
Quite a while.
Yeah. And did come home and was doing well. And that winter, which must have been 73, maybe? No, it's later than that. Doesn't matter. Anyway, she was going back kind of for a refresher. Not that she'd had a slip, but just, you know, there's mm-hmm. a lot involved there.
Mm-hmm.
And her sister said to me, you know, they think it's very good if a person works closely with someone if they go back for the week and kind of learn what it's all about. And Carol wanted me to go. I said, sure, best thing that ever happened. I did not have the problem, but it's just such a good way to live. And I had some emotional issues at that time.
Sure.
So we went and did that, and then later she was a great help to many people who had that problem and was an informal counselor to them, and I just admired her so much
well,
for that.
Well, she sounds like a wonderful person.
Oh, she was just marvelous.
I can't even remember meeting her. I'm sure I did.
Yeah.
But I just don't have a clear recollection of her.
I understand. But she was. And gracious and warm and genuine. And only thing, she had great trouble speaking in public.
Oh.
So there was the A team, and that was Tom. There was the B team, which was Lieutenant Governor, mm-hmm. or the candidate at that time. And we were the C team. But we were really lucky because we
and
got...
And that would be you and Carol.
Yes, because we got to go out to all the smaller places where it wasn't the baked chicken dinner. It was the ladies had done a big potluck.
Yeah.
So we had much better food, and they were always so kind and lovely to us. Mm-hmm. And again, it's the first lady coming to Plains. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were just lovely to us. But so Carol would ask me to, you know, we'd talk about what she wanted to say, and I'd get that rough typed and then somebody to really type. But she just had, and you know, such a common fear. So then she would have a yellow legal tablet, and it would say, "Hello, I'm so very glad to see you." And then a big smiley face. "Thank you for inviting us. I know it will be a wonderful evening." I said, "I'm going to publish a book, Carol, and it will be the unspoken speeches of Carol Judge," which she liked. We got along so very, very well. We really did.
Now, their marriage ended in a divorce, didn't it?
Yes.
Was that while he was still governor?
Yes, it was right before the 1980 campaign.
What happened?
They'd kind of grown apart. She didn't drink. He was kind of too much into it. He'd gotten pretty involved with sort of the big boys and the high flyers and the, you know.
Well,
it was too bad.
Knowing what I think I know, it was a mistake on his part.
Oh, I think it was indeed. Yeah. Although I adored his second wife. She was absolutely wonderful.
She was a hotel owner or something?
Yeah.
Resort owner, maybe?
No, both. Both.
Yeah, okay.
Her mother had died. She came out to...
He didn't remarry until after he was governor.
Oh, he didn't even know. I think he'd been introduced to her, but no, it was later.
Yeah.
Her sister and brother, her brother-in-law and sister were lived in Glendive. He was involved in oil some way.
Yeah.
She was from the Chicago North Shore.
Her name was Cook. Was her maiden name?
No, that wasn't her maiden name. That was her first married name.
I got you.
Yeah.
Okay, that's who I think I
remember. Yeah, and I can't remember what her maiden name was, but she went to the University of Montana with us. I knew her then.
Oh, okay.
But she only went her freshman year
and
went home and married the high school sweetheart and had several children. She got divorced, and her first resort was Chico.
Okay.
Then she went
she
up.
She purchased the resort in Chico, Hot Springs, Montana.
Yes, as I understand it. Now, maybe she was simply the general manager.
Yeah.
But then she went up outside of Columbia Falls and had a dude ranch.
Okay.
She thought that would be a better place to raise her children.
Mm-hmm.
And so she owned that ranch, and that was when I think she married Mr. Koch. They got divorced, and she was managing something. Maybe she was the GM for the hotel in Great Falls mm-hmm. when she met Tom.
What became of Carol?
She and Sherry both went and got a master's degree in nursing. And then I believe she became a counselor. I did not see her that much after the divorce, for which I was sorry.
Yeah.
But I think it was awkward for her. I was still involved with Tom's affairs, business and governmental affairs and so on.
Yeah. Well, that's a sad story.
Well, it is. It is. And while she loved going out and doing all the good things, it was hard for her to live in the governor's mansion.
Why did Schwinden break with Judge and run against him in the primary? Or is that the way to ask the question?
Oh, I think it's fine. It was his third term.
Yeah.
And most everybody just didn't think that was a good idea.
Yeah, they appeared vulnerable because only one governor had actually been elected three times in Montana history, but it was pretty unusual.
And it was at the time of the divorce, it was time of these stories about, you know, high times at the resort, not Big Sky, the one down at the bottom of the hill, you know, that he was drinking and carrying on and hooting and hollering, and people were not happy with his behavior.
Yeah.
And with the divorce, because people were so devoted to Carol, and there were lots of stories floating around and so forth and so on. I will also say that after Ted won, a lot of people said to me, "Oh, I never thought Ted Schwinden would win. I just wanted to kind of teach Tom a lesson." Mm-hmm. And I said, but that isn't how the votes count.
Yeah.
But I mean, truly, a lot of people just thought they were saying to Tom, you better shape up.
Yeah. Well, I interviewed Tom Judge just months before he died.
Oh boy, he was not in good shape
then.
He
wasn't in good shape, and he had some bitterness in addition to some physical problems.
Terrible bitterness.
Yeah, and he made no bones about how he, you know, didn't have a high regard for Ted Swindon. And his friend and your friend and my friend, Kent Kleinkopf, you know, also commented that he knew that was a real rupture there. I don't know if it was a friendship to begin with, really, but anyway, there was
more. I think it was more a pleasant association.
Yeah.
I don't think it was a real friendship
in
that personal
but
sense.
I think Judge felt that he'd really been knifed in the back by Swindon. That was my impression. He may even have said that, for all I remember.
Nope, he may have.
Yeah.
But also because of the fact that all of us volunteered for Ted. I mean, there was a big rupture for a time. And then Emily Melton and I sat down together, and we were very, very good friends. And she said, well, over here, everybody's saying none of the Judge people will help the campaign.
This was after the primary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, well, over there, they're saying, well, they don't want us to help. Nobody ever asks us. Long story short, we got everybody together. And then we all worked very hard. And I mean, I even did some traveling with Ted and Jean and Dory.
Yeah.
And then they got rid of us all.
Well, that's another story, too. That's commonly known, I think, more than some of the other things that you tell me that I wouldn't know otherwise.
Yeah.
And when I talked to you and Larry and Kent. But it was pretty well known that after Ted Swindon was elected governor, he, in some cases, personally fired people who had been on the Tom Judge staff. And it was, apparently he wanted his own team, or maybe there was some retribution involved. I don't know, but...
Well, here's my personal feeling, and he didn't come to me personally.
Yeah.
But first of all, he asked some people right after the election to come to Las Vegas with him.
Richards among them.
Yeah, precisely. So that part was a bigger mistake, Bob.
Yeah. So he goes down to Las Vegas and has a good time with them and their wives. And
precisely.
Then comes back to Helena and cans them all.
You've got it, exactly.
Yeah.
I remember Jean Handel said to me, we were having coffee one morning, she said, you know, if he didn't keep Ron Richards, he's not going to keep you and me. And I said, yeah, I do know that. And so, in fact, we were let go. And some people, Kent Kleinkopf, whom I love, he's one of my favorite people in the world, he's never gotten over that that bitterness.
Yeah.
And I said, but Kent, he ran against us. I mean, that was the thrust of his campaign. I'm going to do it differently. You can't keep the old crowd around if that's what you've run on.
Yeah.
I understood that.
Yeah, I see that.
Yeah, I understood that.
Yeah.
I really did. And, you know, and I, as I say, I'd campaign with him, and I had thought I would continue, mind you. But I really got it. And so then Jim Murray said, you're probably going to need a job. I have four children and not much in the way of any kind of monthly child support. And he said, why don't you come down and talk to Candy Brown? I said, sure. So I did. And Candy said, well, now what are you really looking for? I said, I have no idea specifically, but what I want to do is work with a bunch of people I respect and I like, and we're working for something that's bigger than just making money. And so we talked along those lines a little more, and a few days later, Jim called me in and told me he wanted to offer me a job.
At the state AFL-CIO,
And there were two of them. One was traveling eight states for a worker safety and health program. Well, of course, I couldn't do that. The other was working on calling in the TAP program, technical assistance and training, and Rusty Harper was the other part of that.
Yeah, I remember him.
Love him so much.
Yeah.
And I said, oh my gosh, sure. So I started working there, and it was the middle of a legislature, and Rusty and I are churning out fact sheets and doing research and news releases, and Jim was so nice. I'd come in, bring him a draft, and he'd read it. It's good stuff, Sid. It's good stuff. Now, I think let's add this and that. We did that for about 2 weeks, and I said, Jim, I really appreciate, you know, that you're so positive and complimentary, but you always sound surprised. And he said, I didn't know you could write. I said,
well, he knew you could communicate.
Jim, why did you hire me?
Yeah.
He said, because you were my friend and you needed a job. And he said, Nevin said you'd do fine. So we became great friends. Well, yeah.
Jim Murray was a kind of a multi-sided guy, I think.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no question.
I ended up being...
You need to do an interview with me on him someday.
Yeah, maybe I should. I don't think... Yeah, oh, I did do one with Jim. You know, these are all on file at the University
of Montana
Archives.
Yeah, I really... Yeah.
And I did one with Tom Judge, I just mentioned to you.
Right.
But I did one with Jim Murray, too.
Oh, wonderful.
And because of my Republican past, I remember he was really wary to begin with. And I said, hell, you know, I'm not running for anything anymore. You're retired from the AFL CIO job. We don't need to tell any secrets that we shouldn't or sugarcoat anything. But we both know quite a bit about what happened during our era in politics that future generations or future historians might be interested in.
Exactly.
So we just need to talk on the historical record. And he did a great job.
Yeah.
In fact, I ended up staying at his house that night.
So brilliant and so good. Yeah, I loved him.
And deceptive, because he looked like a labor leader. He didn't look like the intellectual that he was. He didn't look like the...
Yeah, and he'd talk about he always had a torn shirt. And I can't remember when he and Arlene got married, there was this and such thing. And I finally said, well, we didn't have this and that. And I said to somebody, I just outpoured Jim Murray.
Well, boy, Jim, I think Jim expanded his influence and his, frankly, his power in politics by being underestimated by people who And earlier in his life, he had a drinking problem.
Oh, boy,
so
yes.
I think they thought, well, this guy's he looks like a kind of a...
Big thug, Irish drunk, yeah.
Yep, that's right. But he was a whole lot more than that, and he got over that. In fact, I don't
think
he drank at all later on.
Oh, no, and then he'd kid people. Oh, just give me a sniff of that beer. Oh, no, Jim, and he'd laugh. Circling back, though, because I do want to say that Tom's marriage to Susie early on was very, very happy, and she was very good for him, and he had a lot of respect for her business acumen, and she had a ton of money, and I don't mean that influenced him to fall in love with her. But she came from a background that he thought was quite wonderful, et cetera, et cetera. And then she was hired by Dan Rutger of Rutger Corporation, which has all the Thrifty Scott motels and so forth and so on.
I see.
Mountain Sky Guest Ranch had fallen into great disrepair, and I don't think had been used as a guest ranch for a long time. Susie was assigned, she was vice president of development or something, assigned to go down there, bring it up, you know, to speed in every way, and then to manage it. Meanwhile, Tom was working for a group in Salt Lake City, which eventually they say paid somebody a lot of money to call them the Rocky Mountain Group or something exciting. But he was selling investments and stocks, and he would tell me all about it, and I never understood a word, and I was bored to death. But he loved coming down on the weekends to Mountain Sky, and then of course he had some wealthy people he could kind of, you know,
cultivate
exactly.
Yeah. Well,
I think we're done. I mean, my
Do
lord.
Do you have anything you'd like to say in conclusion? But you're
just that I think that was one of the most wonderful opportunities I have ever had in my life to being part of something that made real differences in people's lives. And it was the attitude and the positive sense, and we can do it. But it was also, there was a great deal of federal money for good things, Head Start, child care, et cetera, et cetera. And there was lots of money in Montana.
Yeah, that was when the coal started to
Exactly. So this was something where people who wanted to do good things had the means to do them.
And the political leadership was there. There were progressives in the legislature and in the governor's office and so on.
And Tom once told us, I remember, when Head Start had begun on the Blackfeet Reservation, and he went up to help open it, and he talked about, we were flying in the guard plane back to some conference, and he was telling about some Indian women who came up to talk to him, and they said they were so happy their children would be well and happy and educated, and they could finally go get a job and help their families out of poverty.
Yeah.
And he just got big tears in his eyes when he told us about that.
Yeah.
So there were those good things too. So yeah, to me it was a great blessing to be part of people who wanted to help change people's lives and who actually were able to accomplish
it. In a positive way.
In the most positive way. And we've remained lifelong friends, I might add.
Yeah, and that's wonderful too, you bet.
Yeah, Evan, Kent, Bruce, yes.
Yeah. Well, Sydney Armstrong, it's been my pleasure to do this interview with you. I think this is the longest conversation we've ever had.
And it's been so enjoyable for me.
And it's good to be able to share this conversation with people who may want to listen to it and know more about Montana's second progressive era and Governor Tom Judge sometime in the future.
And who may want it to come back.
Yeah, and who would like to see it return again. God knows that's true.
Yes.
Okay, my friend. Thanks for your public
service. Oh, thank you. Thank you for all you've done for our state. And thank you for putting this program together with all of us that have had good experiences.
Thank you. Great.
Oh, that was so much fun.
Well, you have so much natural enthusiasm. You really do.
Well, that's true.
You really do. And that really helps a lot. I think this is an interview people are kind of probably enjoy listening to.
Oh, I hope so.
You know the worst one I ever had? I told a couple of people this, so it won't make any difference, and it probably wouldn't make any difference to him. My mentor figure in politics, I had two of them, Matt Himsel and a guy named Gene Turnage, who was the Supreme Court.
Oh, Lord, yes.
And I knew.
I was Dan Kemmes' campaign manager
okay, so
that
you know
time.
All about
oh,
that.
You bet.
Well, Turnage was almost like an uncle figure to me.
And he was wonderful.
Oh, boy, he was so good to me and so patient and so knowledgeable and wise and careful and so on. He would have absolutely hated Donald Trump.
Oh, I know.
I don't think he could. He would have probably been outspokenly that way about Donald Trump. Turnage was proper, too, you know.
Oh, precisely.
And he'd been so offended by Trump's boorishness. That's putting it mildly.
Yes.
But anyway, when I interviewed Gene, I thought, well, he'll be real forthcoming. He's such a wonderful storyteller, you know.
Yeah.
So we turned on the recorder, and I thought maybe what came into his mind was that he was doing a deposition. and he didn't want to make any mistakes. And it was absolutely, I mean, you couldn't choreograph on purpose a worse interview than that.
Oh,
he didn't say anything. I didn't just have to crowbar out of him. And, you know, he didn't elaborate on anything. And I don't know, I think we did like a tortured 45 minutes or something like that.
Yeah.
And finally, I just said to hell with it.
Yeah, no, I hear you. No, the whole thing, I ran into Ward Shanahan right after the last, who'd been a friend of mine forever.
Yeah.
Fraternity brother of my husband's. He'd come back after being in the blah, blah, blah. Loved Ward, loved Gail. Into the hospital lobby, and he said, well, I guess you're not very happy. I hated Hillary Clinton, to tell you the truth. But
oh, did you?
That's another story,
yeah.
She was very snippy about the first ladies and thought they were kind of way beneath her.
Oh.
I learned that. It was their first governor's conference. It was our last one.
Yeah.
Anyway, never mind. And he said, yeah, you wouldn't like a Republican. I looked at him and I said, Ward, that man is no Republican. He said, no, he isn't.
He said that about Trump?
Yeah. He said, no, he isn't.
Well, he's another one. I'd be surprised if Ward didn't think that.
Well, precisely.
Yeah, I'd be surprised about that, too. Stan Stevens never caught on to him, at least that he told me. Stan was kind of like a legislator I served with, and you'd remember, too, John Mercer.
Oh, sure.
They couldn't and can't get away from the Republican-Democrat thing.
Yeah.
It's just a barrier they can't climb over the top of.
Right.
I figured, heck, you know, I'm not running for anything.
You and Pat together, that was so wonderful. We all learned so much.
Well, but I guess
but
to get to the
be.
Point I was going to tell you, you know,
it
doesn't really hurt me to tell you this either anymore, because it isn't like I'm admitting that you were right and I was wrong all those years. It's just that when I was in the same party with Bush 1 and Gene Turnage and Matt Himsel and those kinds of people, It was a different thing altogether.
Totally different.
You guys were more progressive than we were, but we were still in the same big tent.
Exactly.
And you realized there had to be a private sector to support the public sector. And we realized in order to have a good civilization and a good life, there needed to be a good public sector to support the private sector.
Yeah.
And that was pretty much understood by everybody. And when I remember when I was a government teacher, I said, a vehicle can't function if it can't start and move ahead and it can't stop. And so the Republican Party is the party of the brake pedal. The Democratic Party is the party of the accelerator. And they're both fundamentally necessary to the operation of the vehicle.
Very good analogy.
And no, we understood that better than now. It's all this goddamn
war. Hold on, I've said to so many people, you know, I worked 2 Senate sessions, and I said there were disagreements on policy and so forth. And I said, there were some jerks, but there were some jerks on our side too.
Yeah.
But eventually,
but they were
really,
driving the bus.
But eventually, all of us had the same idea.
Yeah.
We need to get here.
Yeah.
Now we'll disagree somehow on, do you know Fred Flanders? He's a bank president.
Yeah.
Okay, he's the treasurer of the Greater Montana Foundation.
Okay.
And I just love him. And we work on the budget together. He comes over to my house, we sit at my dining room table and so on. And this was not long after the election. He was in such a rage, and this is a very quiet, kind of a dignified man. He said, I went down to the county. He said, that man is terrible. Of course, they all know my Democratic man. He said, I went down to the clerk and recorder's office, and he said, because I was going to change my party to independent. And he said to me, did you know we don't register by party?
Yeah.
And I said politely, well, yes, I did know that. And he said, and then I get all this junk from the National Party. How do they know my name?
But because he's given them money for some reason.
Well, so I explained all that to him. But he said, that's the worst thing that's ever happened to this country. And I mean, this is a very conservative bank president, but in the best sense of the word.
Yeah.
Oh, we just got to work.
Oh, that's for sure. And you know, Dan Kemis, our mutual friend, is
written,
I think this is his third book, maybe. And it's called America Uniting.
And is this the philanthropy in politics?
Yeah.
Because I was just on a Zoom call with the executive directors in the Helena area. He was so wonderful.
Well, Dan led the discussion on it? Okay, well.
So I told Larry I was going to order the book, but I guess it isn't published yet.
No, I got it. I don't think it's been published very long, but
okay.
I got it and I read it.
Then I think I haven't got the right name. You tell me, Uniting Together?
Americans United or Citizens United.
And I'll just look up his
name. It's not united, it's uniting.
Yeah, okay, good.
And it might have something at like
because he talked about politics and philanthropy.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, and how we were, many of us, trying to achieve the same good goals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
I'll look it up again and I'll order it.
He's kind of theoretical and so on. I've had real trouble finishing his books, but I've waded my way through. This is the most readable, probably. But in it, he makes a point that's just so obvious.
It's yes.
Plain as the nose on an anteater, you know.
Yeah.
that we talk about how these Trump people are a minority. They're even becoming almost a minority of the Republican Party.
Exactly.
So they're not a big, forceful, powerful, dominating majority. How do they have so much influence? Well, we know through apportionment, reapportionment.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of how they do it. They've got sources of money, that's part of how they do it. But also, they're zealots. They really
zealot.
Work
I hadn't
hard.
Thought of that word.
That's what
that
they are.
Is the word.
They think they're doing the Lord's work.
They do.
They're blindly loyal to Trump and to some of these awful other politicians, and they believe them more than their arguments. They don't even understand
argument. Exactly right.
And so he allows us how, look, they did this all legally. They all did it within the system. We can do the same thing. If you think we're going to lose our democracy to an autocracy, isn't that a big enough reason for you to get together? And let's just take a page out of the National Rifle Association's playbook, the NRA. 3 million members. You think they own Congress.
Yep.
Even now when their stock's down.
Yep.
They've got, why? Because they understand how to use technology to contact those guys. They understand how to make signs and wave them in their faces. And they do all the things that people like Bob and Sid and so on don't feel comfortable in doing.
Precisely.
Well, we've got to do it if we want to save our country. That's what he said. You can think that if you want to, but if you want to save the country, you're going to have to beat them at that game. And it's not impossible for us to do by any stretch.
I agree.
We can do it.
I agree. Absolutely. But, oh, my God. And I don't seem to have the energy I used to. I blame it on this new asthma thing.
You blame it on new what?
The new asthma diagnosis.
Oh,
really, I've never had a chronic disease.
Did you ever smoke?
Oh, for years, but I quit in 1990.
Yeah.
1991 something. But I've never had a chronic disease, nor regular medication, nor anything, and it's kind of awful.
Shut this thing.